Herzlich willkommen bei Alles ist Eins. Mein Name ist Christoph Mauer und du hörst diesen Podcast möglicherweise, weil du dich interessierst für das, was in deinem Körper, in deinem Geist und in deiner Seele gerade vor sich geht und du möchtest es besser verstehen. Bevor es richtig losgeht, auch für diese Folge, ich möchte betonen, der Alles ist Eins Podcast dient ausschließlich allgemeinen Informationszwecken und stellt keine Ausübung von Medizin, ärztlicher Heilkunst oder anderen professionellen Gesundheitsdienstleistungen dar, einschließlich der Erteilung medizinischer Ratschläge. Insbesondere wird durch das Anhören des Materials oder die Lektüre von Zusatzmaterial keine Arzt-Patienten-Beziehung gegründet. Die Nutzung der Informationen in diesem Podcast oder von Materialien, die mit diesem Podcast verlinkt sind, erfolgt auf eigene Gefahr. Der Inhalt dieses Podcasts ist nicht als Ersatz für eine professionelle medizinische Beratung, Diagnose oder Behandlung gedacht. Hierfür ist der persönliche Kontakt mit Untersuchungen und individueller Behandlung notwendig. Die Hörer, was bist du, sollen medizinischen Rat einholen, wenn sie krank sind oder krank sein könnten und sollten in solchen Situationen die Hilfe von medizinischem Fachpersonal in Anspruch nehmen. Im Abspann sage ich dir meine E-Mail-Adresse, unter der du mich auch ärztlich erreichst. Möglicherweise ist gerade ein Zeitpunkt in deinem Leben, wo du eine Behandlung haben möchtest, die über das hinausgeht, was derzeit ist. Ich freue mich, von dir zu hören. Und jetzt geht's los.
So, dear listener, this podcast is for general information purposes only and does not constitute the practice of medicine, medical healing or other professional health services, including the giving of medical advice. In particular, no doctor-patient relationship is established by listening to the material or reading of any additional material. Use of the information in this podcast or any materials linked to this podcast is at your own risk. The content of this podcast is not intended as a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. This requires personal contact with examination and individual treatment. Listeners should seek medical advice if they are or may be ill and should seek the help of medical professionals in such situations. So now please, a warm welcome for Jennifer Jasek, who will introduce her latest findings and her book, The Psilocybin Handbook for Women.
What we're going to talk about today is your latest book, and it's The Psilocybin Handbook for Women. And I came across that book when I was researching for the specifics of the of how psilocybin works in women, because it is different to how it works in men, and that has something to do with the cycle, but also with the distribution of serotonin receptors in the brain, which is a specific thing for females. And I studied medicine and I worked in neurology and then did intensive care and all that. So I was deep inside neurotransmitter and receptor stuff. And I never heard of that before until I came over your blog article.
Oh, thank you.
And yeah, I thank you. You enlightened me in that. Could you please tell our listeners why there is a need for a specific female approach to psilocybin, and what does it mean beyond the scientific stuff, but also when it comes to the ritus of the passage, the rites of passage, so to say?
Yeah, absolutely. A great question. So what we're learning is that psilocybin likely affects the female body a little bit differently than it would affect the male body. And that probably has to do with the binding, the serotonin affects like the binding receptors, or it affects binding at the receptor site is what I'm trying to say. And so we have to look a little bit deeper at that in the research. I think that's really important that we continue research on that. So this is just some preliminary information that we have, but it also likely affects the menstrual cycle, which we can discuss later. I won't get too deep into that right now. But I think it's also important to consider that there are major differences in the lived experiences of men and women. And women are more disproportionately affected by things like PTSD, chronic pain, depression, anxiety. There are a lot of conditions that just simply disproportionately affect the female body, or they may affect the female body slightly differently. And what I started learning when I started diving into the research was that actually more women are using some psychedelics more than men are, which surprised me. But then the more I dug, it didn't surprise me. And the reason for that is because I think women are really using psychedelics to self-treat. And that comes out in surveys and polls, including the 2020 Global Drug Survey, shows that women are using psychedelics to self-treat instead of using them recreationally, which men tend to do. Not that there's anything wrong with using psilocybin recreationally. We're just noticing that women are turning to these plant medicines to self-treat. And the reason that really doesn't surprise me, as a woman in the United States, where healthcare has a lot of problems, so women were largely excluded from early stage clinical trials until about the 1990s. And so that's had some dramatic ramifications for how we treat conditions in the female body. For one, I can look at this timeline that I always like to share when I'm being interviewed, because I think it really illustrates this. So men had a drug for male sexual dysfunction in 1998. And everyone knows what that is. It's Viagra. It's like this common household name at this point. And at that point in time, we didn't even have an accurate picture of what the clitoris looks like. So it has all this internal structure, and we didn't learn that until 2015, when a female urologist did some research on this. And then fast forward to 2015, that's when women finally got a drug for female sexual dysfunction. And it's a name I don't even have in my head. I always have to look it up again to remember what it is. It's just not well known. So that's a 17-year gap from when men got a drug for a condition to when women got a drug for a condition. And I think that's a really dramatic spread there. And so I understand why women are turning to psychedelics, but we also, again, have very different lived experiences. And that matters too in how we approach psychedelics. So the book really tries to look at all that intersection of the female body with the context of psilocybin.
Awesome. Yeah. That's what about it. That's all it is about. Is the first 130 pages I counted. It's really a wholesome introduction into what is to be known. And right. you mentioned a lot of correspondence you had with state of the art researchers. There was one page where I read what you that with you talked with Dr. Calder from Switzerland. Yeah. And I thought, oh, I have to email to her about the helioscope effect. And then next side, there was, and there's the helioscope effect. And there's a really interesting thing. And the book by Hasler, who is a colleague and close co-worker and co-author of Dr. Calder as well, is, I think, a standard setting for the German language area. For those, which is the grammar and vocabulary of research, and also of description of the phenomenology of not only psilocybin but psychedelics in a whole. And whenever there will be a translation of the Hasler book, it's called Higher Self. You will love that.
I know, I will. I appreciate that helioscope metaphor so much that he created, and that's so brilliant.
Yeah, it is. It is. For listeners, could you wrap it up, the metaphor?
Yeah.
Please.
Yeah, so there's this term in the psychedelic literature called the helioscope effect. And as you mentioned, this is from Dr. Gregor Hasler, and it was shared to me by Dr. Abigail Calder. And so what it is that a helioscope is an instrument for looking at the sun, because you're not supposed to look directly at the sun, of course. And so when we are on psychedelics, we have our own sort of helioscope effect where when we think of a helioscope as an instrument for looking at the sun, it protects your eyes, and also it gives you almost like a new filter of the sun. So you're seeing it at a different perspective and in a safe way, right? So when we are on psychedelics, we have a very similar effect happening where we can look at trauma, almost viewing it through a helioscope, if you will. And that gives us this safe distance to view the trauma from. And we can also reprocess it in a different way, because not only are we viewing it from a safe distance, we're getting a new filter for it. And so it seems like that is such a great metaphor for explaining this, the way that we can process traumas on a psychedelic. So I love that.
Yeah, exactly. So if you would burn your eyes when looking directly into your sun. You would burn your soul if you look into your trauma again and again. But the helioscope effect of psychedelics prevents this burning and helps to heal.
Yeah. It's great. And it's like almost as if we are stopping the triggering response that we have to thinking about our trauma or looking at our traumas. It reduces those triggers that we tend to have.
Yeah. That does not mean that instead of triggers, there appear glimmers, but there's still a trigger, but right. It has not the same impact into
exactly. So well said. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. I totally love your enthusiastic way to look into the not only the subject, but also talking about that. All your blog articles, everything I heard from you and other podcasts, there's such a lot of fire inside.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm very passionate about women's health, especially. But as we dig into all of the research on psychedelics, I even get more excited about that because I do see so much potential for psychedelics to help with women's health, especially since it seems like women's health is often put on the back burner.
It is. Also in clinical studies, and it is explained with the simple claim because it's too complicated. Because of the cycle. So they are excluded from clinical trials because it's too complicated. But here you go, clinicians, try all the medications, try all the protocols we invented on male individuals and male study mm-hmm. groups, and do your very best. Have luck.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
So you benefited yourself from psilocybin with women health issues.
Yeah. So just to kind of take a step back and explain my history with women's health. So I have a condition called endometriosis, and that affects 1 in 10 people assigned female at birth. Occasionally, very rarely, it can affect the male body as well. But by and large, it mostly affects the female body. And it takes on average about 10 years for women to get a diagnosis of this condition, which can be really frustrating. And there's not adequate treatments. And there's no cure for it. It's a very painful condition and affects every facet of your life. And it certainly has done that with mine. So it's a very complicated situation. But so recently, about 5 years ago, I had a hysterectomy, and that helped me quite a bit. Although I really want to say that hysterectomy is not a cure for endometriosis. It can potentially help, but it's not a cure. And so that has helped me quite a bit. However, I still do have a lot of pain, and it's just not as bad as it used to be before the hysterectomy. So psilocybin has helped me to a certain extent with this condition a little bit. In addition to the endometriosis, I also get, which is very related to endometriosis, I get menstrual migraine, where around the time of where I would have a period, I no longer have one because I don't have uterus anymore, but where I would get my period, I get a bad migraine essentially. And it's one that can be really, really debilitating, where I will, vomit and I need to be in a dark room and lie down. And I had a dramatic reduction in menstrual migraine symptoms after doing my psilocybin journey. And then going back, circling back to the endometriosis topic, another thing that I found through my research, which just fascinated me, was that researchers did an experiment with 4 psilocybin extracts. And so they're like mushroom extracts in water. And then they took cells from a lab and, put the extracts on the cells. And they noticed a reduction in pro-inflammatory cytokines. And I forget what it's called. It's called COX-2. I'm forgetting the full name of it. But a reduction in the expression of COX-2, which is it's almost like a pain signal that people feel.
Cyclooxygenase 1.
There we go. Thank you, doctor. And so what we learned from this experiment, and again, this is just an initial study, but it reduced these pro-inflammatory cytokines. And the researchers were not digging into whether or not psilocybin could help with endometriosis. However, my brain went light bulb moment here. And I was thinking, well, I wonder, if it could help with endometriosis in that capacity. And so what we do know about endometrial growths or endometrial lesions is that, or endometriosis lesions, as I should say, they express pro-inflammatory cytokines, and they express that COX-2, or they overexpress it. And so that's why we have a lot of inflammation in our bodies and a lot of pain when we have endometriosis. So I do see some potential for psilocybin to help with that. Again, we need actual research on whether this really does help with endometriosis, but I see some, you know, promising avenues for researchers to start to study.
Thank you. One of the last questions I wanted to ask you, if you see anything, any research which is worth doing in the next years. So endometriosis is one of those. I'm intrigued Definitely. By the fact that this migraines did well cease after one time intake. You wrote about your first journey in the book, and it was also a very spiritual journey, as far as I understood yeah. what happened to you, and also impacted, well, yourself and your relationship and many aspects of your life. That definitely has something to do with the migraine as well, because not only the cycle has an influence on migraine activity and severance of migraines, but also so many factors of your everyday life, of your psychosocial net, so to say.
Absolutely.
And did that last for longer?
Yeah, you know, it's actually really fascinating, because people keep asking me, like, how often are you using psilocybin? And I'm like, well, not very often. I, you know, did a journey with the macrodose last August, and I haven't done one since, but I have done a little bit of microdosing. But that journey was incredibly powerful and profound for me. It did reduce pain, and that was lasting for about, I would say, 6 months or so. I did have a return to some menstrual migraine, but not as intense as before. So I've had, you know, lasting benefits from this. Again, I can't attribute it directly to the psilocybin. We don't know for sure if that's the case, but that's what I suspect. And then, in terms of my, you know, well-being and my, you know, social life and things like that, it has really helped me quite a bit. So, my well-being, I used to have a lot of anxiety about this concept of eventually losing my parents. And, ever since I did the journey, I now know I have the tools to get through that really difficult time in my life. It's coming at some point. Before, it seemed like I would never be able to handle that or get through it. And now I know I can, even though it will be very difficult. I have the tools within my own brain to help me get through that. Plus, I have an incredible support system. And one of the things that I think we learn when we use psilocybin is we may know that we have a support system, but to really feel it, that was a sensation that I got during my journey. I could feel all these people who love me, and I love them back. I could feel their love. You know, I could actually just feel it. And that was really incredible. But circling back to what you asked if there's something that I'm hoping researchers dig into more as we move forward in the psychedelic research era. I really think that people need to be focusing on the female body, of course, but also very particularly, how does psilocybin affect the menstrual cycle? We have some preliminary research that suggests that it does potentially cause a period to come a little early after use. And I'm getting this from anecdotal reports from people in my Instagram direct messages and things like that. But also, Johns Hopkins University did some research on this, some case studies of women reported that their cycles came early. Additionally, some women have reported that there's a return to having a period after a time of not having one, or amenorrhea, and then also that it has the potential to re-regulate a cycle after a period of irregularity. So a lot of conditions cause an irregular menstrual cycle. So there's probably some potential here for psilocybin to help with these conditions. And these might be premenstrual dysphoric disorder, polycystic ovarian syndrome, which I think you have done some research on, And then also potentially endometriosis, though I do not want to classify endometriosis as a menstrual cycle disorder because it's absolutely an inflammatory condition. And yes, absolutely, it's much more than that. So what we're seeing is that, or what researchers are thinking is that, so our cycles occur along what's called the hypothalamic pituitary gonadal axis, which you are well versed in. And what I mean by that is there's a feedback loop where when one hormone kicks off, it tells another hormone what to do. And then we also have what's called the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis, which is really involved in our stress response. And when we use psilocybin, we're activating our serotonin receptors along that stress response. And these two axes overlap. So it's not a stretch to assume that a psilocybin journey activating along that stress response impacts the menstrual cycle potentially in a positive way, or vice versa, where we are in our cycles may impact our journey if we're doing a macro dose. And it may matter where we are in our cycles and also for a macro dose and for a micro dose.
Thank you. And that was where I wanted to drop in. Are we talking macro dosing or micro dosing in this case? Where do you see the difference? Also, how to integrate it in your everyday life? You can't be macro dosing each weekend.
Right. Yeah. If you were macrodosing every weekend, you know, you would build up a tolerance. And of course, who has the time for that? You know, because you do want to block out quite a good amount of time to do a macrodose. So I would see that people could be macrodosing, you know, once or twice a year, maybe more, maybe a little bit more, but not too frequently. And then with, and it may matter where we are in our cycles. I did talk to an indigenous wisdom expert, and she shared that it's probably better to do a macrodose near your ovulation time rather than as we get closer to our menstruation. And that is simply because our bodies become a little bit more insulin resistant in the luteal phase, which is the second half of our cycles. And, you know, so it's really hard. So a macrodose can be kind of energy depleting on the body, and that can be much more difficult towards your cycle. I mean, towards your bleed. So when you're closer to ovulation, you have more sort of energy availability in your body. So that was one thing to consider. And then in terms of microdosing, so if people don't know, a microdose is almost like a tenth of a gram, you know, around there. There's a range that could be working for a microdose, whereas a macrodose is something more like 2, 3, 3.5, 4 grams, somewhere in there. And so with microdosing, my indigenous wisdom expert recommended following whatever protocol you're going to follow. There are several out there, like Stamets Stack or the Fadiman protocol, and I do write about those in the book. But follow that, whatever protocol you're doing, follow it for 3 months, and keep track of your symptoms throughout your cycle, especially if you're having some type of symptom. Note if there's a reduction in symptoms, all of that, because it takes about 3 months for that microdosing to really, for you to really know how the microdosing is affecting you and affecting your cycle.
You talking about this as if it would be legal. You're from Tennessee.
Oh.
And it is, yes. It is decriminalized where you are.
No, it's not. No, Tennessee is like, you're not allowed anything. Yeah, no.
Yeah, I was also, repeat for the German listeners, up to now it's a criminal in here, and we do have an option in Europe, that is the Netherlands. They do not have the above the surface mushrooms in a legal way, but truffles. They differ a little bit in the dosing, so that you have to just know your stuff, and it's possible to do. But whoever is as optimistic as I am for the near future, there's such a lot of work already. There's a big trial in Germany that is about the episode trial, and you've heard of that, I'm sure. It's about how to bring psilocybin and psychotherapy together. I think it's a really important thing. Also, with regard to the two-eyed seeing, which will be my next question.
Oh, wonderful.
And there is some work. There's work in solid German universities, and it is a matter of time and nothing else until it will be broadly available. And talking about psychedelics and substances, and you know, marijuana is a atypical psychedelic that is planned to be legal from January 24 in Germany. And you, yes, it is. You may have some little amounts, and a little amount is 25 grams.
Oh, wonderful. Okay, so that's great.
Yeah, that's the solid work that what was done there, and it's pretty awesome for many people and helps them to self-treat conditions that are unseen by the medical community. So coming back to seeing and unseeing and two-eyed seeing, and that is integrating indigenous wisdom, and you reference to your nature medicine woman, together with Western medicine protocols. What do we get from that? And where does that lead us to?
Yeah, so the two-eyed seeing concept, for anyone who's not familiar, is a concept that was introduced by a Mi'kmaq elder named Albert Marshall, and he was from the Eskasoni First Nation, I believe. And so he brought this idea to, mainstream Western science, where we need to be bridging Western medicine and all the research that's coming out with indigenous wisdom. So science is a process, or we all think of science as a process of doing things over and over again to reproduce similar results, to confirm those results. But that's exactly what indigenous cultures have been doing for centuries, with especially psilocybin, which is, considered a sacred substance. And so it's really important that we bridge these two. And I think that's when we get the best results for people. And that's because if you think about the context of there's a term in psychedelic language called set and setting. And so what that means is that as you're going into a journey, you want to be in the right mindset, and because your mindset matters going into it. If you're all stressed out or panicked, it could lead to a difficult journey. And then setting is what's around you. So your environment, who's around you? Do you feel comfortable in your environment? Are you inside? Are you outside? And so a lot of our practices surrounding set and setting really come from indigenous wisdom and or indigenous traditions. And so I think those lend us having a really good the potential for having the best experience possible is when we really focus on those indigenous practices that do help really calm your mind, calm your body, and keep you in an environment that's really conducive to having a better journey. And it's just important to honor the indigenous cultures that really gave us psilocybin in the first place.
Talking about a better journey as compared to a bad journey, or usually refers to a bad trip. What is a bad trip? And you wrote, it appears more often in women, as far as I understood. That's a reason for that. But what do you do to prevent a bad trip? And what would you recommend doing when it happens, despite all measures taken up front?
Yeah, this was really great information from Abigail Calder. She was amazing to talk to. But she talked a lot about, we do need to acknowledge that people do have bad experiences, or oftentimes what we're trying to call them instead is challenging experiences. Because what we're learning through research is that even when people do have a difficult or challenging experience in psilocybin, it could be really profound. So people do report that it's, even though they've had a difficult trip, it's their top 10 most profound experiences of their lives. So a challenging part of it, you could just have a challenging part of a trip. Your entire trip could be really challenging. It just really depends. But what that might mean is having some anxiety crop up, or seeing things you don't want to see in terms of the visuals, or just feeling kind of out of place or disoriented. Those things could lead to a difficult journey. But what's sort of protective about that is trying to go into your journey with a mindset of being open to whatever the mushroom wants to teach you. If you go in with all of these intentions, I mean, you can have some intentions, but if you're so focused on them, you could get stuck in sort of this thought cycle that's not very beneficial or conducive to a journey. So going into a journey with just the most open mind possible about letting the trip take you where it's going to take you, that can really help. And not having a lot of stress beforehand or deadlines on your plate coming up, just really blocking out enough time to feel comfortable to go through the whole journey. I think that can also be really protective. In terms of getting through a difficult journey, if you're experiencing one, you know, lean into your tools that you already have within your body to calm yourself, sit with the discomfort, that sort of thing can really also help. It did help me. I had a difficult spot in one of my journeys, and it was good to just sit with that discomfort a little bit, even though we don't like to sit with discomfort. It was really important for me to do that. Besides, I couldn't do anything else. I couldn't unsubscribe from the journey. I couldn't end it. I just had to write it out, and it was okay. And it really was profound for me.
There is a drug that would end the hallucinogenic effects of psilocybin at once, which is risperidone. It's an antagonist for the serotonin receptor group, but it is not recommended to do that, because if the trip does not feel comfortable, then there is a reason for that, and then you just have to sit through that, and it depends so much on the setting, how you are guided through this, I guess.
Right. Absolutely. And, you know, I think it was Dr. Calder who brought up a really important thing. And that is that whoever you're with, if you're with a guide or a psychedelic assisted therapist, who's ever with you, helping you navigate the journey, they shouldn't necessarily be interfering with your journey. It should be kind of unfolding as it is, but they're there to keep an eye on you, keep you safe, help you if you do come up with a difficult part, but not really interfering with that process, and that could sort of interrupt the whole thing that you have going on. Yes. So that was an important thing that she mentioned.
Well, that is a kind of surrender to the wisdom of the mushroom, so to speak, for both sides, for the one who takes them and the one who guides them. Just accept that you don't have to jump in at every occasion and try to form the root, which won't work anyway.
Right. Yes. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. There are, if you think microdosing, there are some specific fields that affect women, but men as well. So one might be potential sexual health benefits, but also, and I was intrigued to read that, when it comes to parenting.
Oh, yes.
That was a surprise for me to read, because I grew up in a time where Germany was heavily influenced by the American-born drugs. The German culture is heavily influenced by American culture in many, many ways. So something that happens in the U.S. happens 10 years later in Germany. That is hip-hop and graffiti and grunge and everything, like 10 years later. And also the war on drugs came 10 years after the Vietnam War. So then it reached Germany. And we did have slogans on T-shirts as pupils with strong without drugs, stuff like that. So people are primed that taking drugs, it's inherently dangerous and will risk your life, and you will go down the drain to some very unpleasant state, not only during your journey or trip, as it was called then, but like all your life.
Right.
That does not happen on psilocybin.
No.
That is one thing. It is one of the safest substances to consume, despite not being very funny each time. But it's one of the safest. But then you come up with parenting. And what is the point with that? That it's so counterintuitive to what I just told you about my socialization with substances.
Yeah, you know, obviously the war on drugs in the U.S. and any ramifications that the U.S. spread to the rest of the world with that have created a lot of damage and misinformation or disinformation about these substances. So, yes, as you mentioned, psilocybin is one of the least toxic substances, if we're talking about drugs, it's on par with marijuana, right, in terms of its toxicity, very low toxicity. So that's great. And in terms of parenting, what I discovered is that certainly we have to consider whether or not someone who is pregnant might benefit from psilocybin use if they're having a mental health disorder that needs treatment. And so the people, the experts that I talked to said, yeah, we need to take that into consideration. And for example, the Indigenous wisdom expert that I worked with, she talked about how when she was pregnant, she was grappling with alcoholism and her alcohol use disorder. And she used psilocybin while pregnant to abstain from alcohol. And so there was certainly no harm done to her child. And there's no evidence of harm out there from psilocybin on pregnant people. We're not doing studies on pregnant people, of course, but we need to take that into consideration that, you know, the Indigenous cultures have done this historically. And then with breastfeeding too, I incorporate a bunch of information in the book on the half-life of psilocybin. So if for example, if you wanted to use psilocybin while breastfeeding and you were worried about any of that being passed on to your infant, you can, you know, create strategies around your usage with, especially with microdosing for breastfeeding. So that information is out there. And then in terms of just relationships, the family environment, I see a lot of potential for psilocybin to help with this sort of family unit. For example, kids play all the time, right? And it's a little bit harder as an adult to let go of all of your to-do lists and your stress and all the tasks that are on your plate and get down on the floor and play with your kid, you know, play Legos or whatever it is. And so psilocybin helps us get back to this state of childlike wonder and awe. And so I'm not saying that people need to, you know, be tripping while they're caring for their kids. That's not what I recommend. However, if you go and do a journey, there's a little bit of a lasting effect linking you back to that childlike state of wonder and awe. And so I think it helps people feel much more present with their kids, being able to play, get down on the floor, enjoy that time. It helps reduce some of the stressors of parenting. And then also a consideration is helping to end cycles of trauma. So there are these things called adverse childhood experiences, or in scientific literature, it's called ACEs for short. And so ACEs are things that happened in childhood that were traumatic. So that could be living through a war, living through a natural disaster, having abuse or neglect in your home, domestic violence in the home, living through systemic racism. All of these things create are adverse childhood experiences, and they actually alter your stress response, and they can alter your DNA that you pass down to your children. And so oftentimes we don't have any control over how many adverse childhood experiences we've had. 1 in 6 adults has had four or more ACEs. And when you've had 4 or more ACEs, your child is more than 3 times more likely to have 4 or more ACEs themselves. And so we have this problem in our society of just passing this trauma down. And so I see potential for psilocybin to help ease some of the stressors and things that we're facing with our own traumas, so that we help to end these cycles. Now, we may not be able to do anything about passing down the genetic aspect of it. However, trauma can occur because we're perpetuating the things that we learned from our own childhood. So if we grew up in a very volatile household, we may end up having very volatile households as well. And so that environment can also pass it down. And so that's where I see the potential for psilocybin to help in sort of stopping the passing down of the ACEs. Because one of the things that's really protective for children in terms of preventing them from having ACEs is having this really healthy family environment. And so if we can do all the things that we can to create that healthy family environment, we're setting the kids up for success later on.
It's the most precise and concise definition of passing trauma over generation that I ever heard. Thank you very much for that. I don't know if everybody understood what was said in the last 5 minutes. This is really, really important, not only considering a behavior and how you treat your kids and how you treat yourself, which is the same essentially, but also you talked about epigenetics. So there is something how the book of your life, the book of your DNA is read the words may be the same from one individual to the other, but how you pronounce them, how often you read them, how much you get stuck with one word and don't come to the next paragraph, that is epigenetics. And that is something that deeply impacts our life, our behavior, well, really on the surface, and also how diseases will come up in your life and influence your later health. Thank you for the awesome explanation.
You're welcome. And just continuing this talk about ACEs, I think it's really important to know that that permanent, that that changing of your stress response, there's some permanence to that. And so when a child who's had some ACEs gets into adulthood, they're disproportionately more likely to have things like type 2 diabetes, obesity, all of these things that affect our metabolic health. And so your life history really keeps informing the things that you go through down the road in terms of your health. And so one thing that really surprised me when I was doing some of the research was that if you've had four or more ACEs, you're more likely to have worse menopause symptoms. So this circles back to the women's health aspect, which is really interesting that our traumas could affect how we go through our experience in menopause. And so, you know, we also don't want to be passing this trauma down to kids and then affecting their physical health as well in terms of increasing their risk for type 2 diabetes, obesity, high cholesterol, all of these things that could then continue to affect their lives going forward.
Yeah. Yes, that is, obesity definitely is an answer to stress. I recently read a book chapter on that, and I see if I can send it to you. I've got it on paper, but I do my very best. I will mail that to you afterwards.
Thank you.
Because the brain works to survive, and in some states and in some constellations, it does not give attention to what happens to the body, but just gets energy to survive. The egoistic brain theory, it is called. And it's, well, it's selfish, actually. But it's a matter of survival. So this selfishness is, has kind of a reason to perform. Oh, yes. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Oh, that's still really interesting. Maybe people can understand your enthusiasm about this. Well, it's not a substance at all, but it is, you nailed the term entourage effect. And that is something that might be, and here we come back to the women talk we do here, that is something that might be more important for females than men. Mm. And that is interesting because studies often are done with the psilocin or psilocybin in a cleared or synthetical formulation, sure. And that is something completely different. So that would be like eating protein versus eating a steak.
Right. Yes. Yeah. That's really interesting. And so the entourage effect is, if anyone isn't aware, is when two compounds tend to work well together to produce an effect. So we often talk about the entourage effect in terms of cannabis. And so we can think of these different compounds like CBD and THC in the cannabis plant working really well together to produce results. Like CBD maybe can help keep a person calmer on THC, because THC can bring up anxiety for some people or paranoia and things like that. But what we're talking about with psilocybin, there's potential that the female hormones may have some type of entourage effect. Now, we don't know if estrogen creates a better effect or a negative effect. We're still trying to study that, but there is evidence that that there is some type of interaction there. We just don't know all the specifics of that yet.
So, but it is promising, I guess.
Yes. I think so. Yeah, I think it could be very promising that, and again, this would come back to where we are in our cycles really may matter. We need more research on that. And I'm looking forward to people continuing to study that. So I think these things are yet to be elucidated fully, but I'm excited that people are looking into it.
It prompts us to maybe preferring the natural substance and its natural occurrence in a mushroom or a truffle rather than using a synthetic solution which will come. There is a lot of psychedelic investment right now, and there are many companies, and that has an upside, which maybe is the more popularity, there's more widespread information, but also there's a capitalization of the substance and of the supply chains and all that. So we'll see where that leads us, and we might be old school right now with our inner orientation to the grown substance.
Yeah, you know, I'm still in that concept of, you know, I would prefer the natural substance rather than using some type of synthetic option. I understand why pharmaceutical companies are moving towards that direction of creating synthetic psilocybin. Obviously, they want to capitalize on it, as you mentioned. And I'm a little weirded out by that. I don't like that capitalization on this sacred substance. I do think we need really good regulation out there in terms of, I want to know if I'm purchasing mushrooms from some dispensary or something like that, I want to know what it is, the strain, what, you know, all the compounds that are in it. I want to know that. So that type of regulation, similar to, we have a lot of cannabis regulation in the US where I can pull up when I go to a dispensary, or if I'm thinking about going to a dispensary to buy cannabis, I can look up the product that I want to buy and look at the certificate of analysis and see how much pesticides are in it, or, you know, if they're using chemicals, and see the exact amounts of THC and CBD and other cannabinoids in the cannabis plant that are used for this product. And so, or that are actually in the product specifically. And I think that is really important, and it would be helpful with psilocybin, because if you're ordering psilocybin capsules on, you know, on a back channel or something like that in an underground fashion, it's always beneficial to test your substance to make sure there's not something in it that you don't want to ingest. And so, I do want the natural substance of psilocybin to have greater access for people and for people to feel safe purchasing it. That's important. But I do get weirded out by the synthetic issue, or the topic of synthetic psilocybin. I'm wondering, does it really have those same effects? And maybe I'm uneducated about that. I need to learn more.
I'm sure you are not uneducated.
Thank you for saying that.
I really have to repeat myself. This is a very comprehensive and great approach to the art of mushrooming. Do you plan to translate it into German?
Oh, I don't know yet.
Or someone, not you, obviously.
Oh, yeah. I mean, obviously, I couldn't personally do that. But yeah, I don't know what my publisher has planned in terms of translation for other languages. I would love that. I've certainly had a lot of requests. So hint, hint, publisher, we need translations out there.
Yeah, we need to flood him with emails. Yeah,
like, right? Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, there was some smart question, but it's lost on the way. Sorry.
No, that's okay.
Yeah, thank you very much. I think we covered a lot of different subjects you also covered in here, and now we're able to explain in more depth than it is possible in the written book, also to do some connections that cannot be written but can really easily be explained. Thank you so much for your time. Thank you so much for your mission. I would love to make a photo of you in your little research corner here for people listening. You definitely should search this photo, because there's your book, and there's mushroom on the wall, and there are some mushrooms in a glass. That's a really awesome surrounding. Is this your interview corner, or is it your working space?
It's both. I have like a little day bed or sofa here, and I like to sit here, and I have this little like lap desk that I use. And so I just feel really cozy when I'm researching and writing rather than sitting at a desk. I know I'm weird.
Yeah. Well, I think normal is a really strange concept. So
right.
I love to have a little insight into your weird corner. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
My dear listener, while I'm recording this, and maybe while you are listening to this episode, psilocybin containment plants are all over the globe wildly illegal, and I definitely would not encourage you to do anything illegal or that might get in trouble with authorities. This being said, if you still want to use psilocybin containing plants for whatever reason, then you might as well do it in a way that will help your health and not endanger your mental or your physical health. So we get three key learnings from this interview, I guess. The first is psilocybin affects the female body differently than the male body. And this is due to differences in serotonin receptors and the menstrual cycle, as a matter of fact. More research is needed on optimizing psilocybin therapies for women and with a special concern of this issue. Indigenous wisdom and rituals can provide important context and guidance for psilocybin journeys. And we are better off combining indigenous knowledge with Western medicine. This might prove to be key to the widespread acceptance as a means of therapy or coaching, as I guess will be the use of the acceptance in the therapeutic session. And third, psilocybin could help break generational trauma by easing parental stress and promoting healthy family bonds. And this may reduce adverse childhood experiences. And if none of the points did convince you that it's a good substance, maybe this point can. And given the importance of this very specific idea, well, that is worth standing our ground and spreading the word and waiting how it will develop in therapeutic or coaching context. Thank you for listening. I'd love to hear your questions or your ideas on everything that you heard there. You'll find the link to this really awesome book, which I highly recommend, in the show notes. And now stay tuned for everything that will come from Jennifer's blog or from her pipeline of books. And stay tuned for the podcast. Thank you.